there is a lot of eating in the Bible. Some meals in the Bible are just meals. Some meals are more than meals. There are times when eating a meal sends a message, when eating a meal makes a statement, like choosing up sides. When the Jewish people kept the Feast of the Passover, they were keeping an appointment with God. The significance of the Passover meal was not physical nourishment, although it included that, of course, but that was not the point. Eating that meal was a declaration of one's faith in the God of Abraham. They could have eaten at home alone if it had been a matter of filling their stomachs. But eating the Passover with others at that time of year was not just another meal. It was making a statement about belonging to Jehovah God. There are a lot of meals in the Bible. When Jesus one day ate a meal with some shady characters, some crooks, and some prostitutes were there, Jesus was criticized for eating the meal. Now, why would that happen? Does it matter who sits across the table from you when you eat? Is that really significant in God's eyes? You remember the time when Peter visited in the home of the Italian family? He told Cornelius about Jesus. Before Peter left the Gentile home, all of the adults in the family and home had accepted Jesus as Lord and were immediately baptized into the family of God. When Peter went back to Jerusalem, a lot of people were extremely upset with him. And their charge against Peter was, "You ate with them." Sometimes a meal is a lot more than a meal. A few weeks ago in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul told the men and women of this church, if any church member is immoral, or if he is dishonest, or if he's greedy, or if he's a drunkard, do not associate with him, and especially don't eat with him. Why not? What's wrong with eating with anybody? Does it matter where we eat? Does it matter with whom we eat our meals? And the answer is, yes. Sometimes it matters. In some circumstances, to eat means to approve. In some settings, to participate in the meal is to belong. To eat means I'm one of them. To participate is identifying with them. Not always, but sometimes. Last week, we looked over the shoulder of the Apostle Paul as he showed the Corinthians several pictures from the Old Testament. There was one picture of thousands of people who were eating out in the middle of the desert. We called it a picnic. It wasn't actually a picnic, but it was like a picnic. They were eating food that God had provided for them. After they ate God's food, then these same people made idols and committed adultery. And they criticized everything God was doing for them. In the next picture, they're all dead, and God punished them for their sin. But there were lots of other people who did the same thing, like the Egyptians, the Philistines, the Moabites. Lots of other peoples made idols, committed adultery, and probably were very negative about a lot of things in general. But they did not die prematurely. Why not? And I'm not sure how to say this. I don't know if I can make it clear. It is unacceptable to eat God's food and to identify yourself with him and then to ignore him like he was dirt. Let's play suppose. Suppose, you know that the speed limit on Griner Road is 40 miles an hour. You know that? Let's suppose that there is a car going down Griner Road 55 miles an hour. The car is stopped by a policeman. No points, no marks on the license, no smell of alcohol on the breath, license plates on the car from out of state. A merciful policeman gives the driver a warning, a verbal warning. No ticket, no arrest. The driver is free to go. The driver takes the car down to the next intersection, turns around, and comes flying back up Griner Road at 55 miles an hour right past the same policeman. And this time, guess what? No more warning. No more mercy. The driver is stopped, arrested, and will be punished for breaking the law. God is patient with us when we sin because he does not want anybody to perish. God is patient. But when people know better and still disobey, they will be punished. Now, the Egyptians, the Philistines, the Moabites did not have revelation from God. They had very limited knowledge about what was right and wrong. But Israel knew better. They had eaten at God's table. They had spent time with God. They acted like they respected him. Actually, they didn't respect him. They were punished. The Corinthians had an eating problem. They figured that they could eat anywhere, anytime they wanted, with anybody. And generally speaking, all of us are free to do that, to eat what you want, where you want, when you want, with whom you choose. But their problem was that they were involved in those situations where participation means identification. If a man eats at Bob Evans once a month, that's okay. I hope. Is that okay? If a man eats at Bob Evans twice a month, that'd be okay. But if the same man faithfully attends the monthly banquet sponsored by the Buffalo Chapter of Homosexuals United, that's not just a meal. In that case, participation is identification. Most of you know the background of the Corinthians. They had been idol worshippers from their birth. They grew up at the temple. They hung around the temple. They enjoyed what it offered. The temples of idols were not quite like anything we have on Transit Road. Can you imagine a nightclub, a restaurant, a church, and a whorehouse all under one roof? That's what pagan temples were. Four in one, owned and operated by the same people, same crowd. People went to the temple for dining, for entertainment, for prostitution, for worship. Personally, I don't think men go to Hooters for food. In Corinth, the temples were the hot spots. In Corinth, the movers and the shakers spent their free time at the temples, the politicians, the power brokers, the athletes of the day, the important people, the elite, all spent their free time at the temple. Why not? The temple had every worldly pleasure anybody could want. Generally speaking, temple food was okay. Temple food was fresh. It was good. Lots of it. Reasonable price. Temple food was okay, but the rest of it was immoral and wrong. In my mind, one of the wonders of the world, I don't think I've ever seen this listed in the seven wonders of the world, ancient or modern. In my mind, one of the wonders of the world is that the story of the cross of Christ could convert and transform men and women who grew up in ancient first century paganism. The Corinthian Christians had come a long, long way. They understood that Jesus was the Son of the living God, the only God, the creator of heaven and earth and all therein. They knew that. They understood now that idols are not gods. Idols are nothing. Idols are pieces of stone that have been given names. The Corinthians concluded, if an idol is nothing but a piece of stone, then they had nothing to fear from an idol. That was their conclusion. Feeling confident in their new knowledge, they decided that they would return to the temple for meals. They were eating and spending time as Christians at the temple of the idols on a regular basis. And so in the last half of chapter 10, much of which Keith read for us, Paul said, idols are nothing, but idolatry is real. This was a delicate issue even for a man who was led by the Spirit of God in what he wrote. And you can just sense as Paul writes from verse 14 on how he is laboring with something that is going to be so hard to differentiate and put in print because it was ingrown in their minds and their worldview. And so Paul started by setting the stage. He didn't call them brethren or brothers like he has earlier in the letter. This time, Paul said, my beloved. And he is expressing strong affection because he's going to deal with a delicate issue, but he wants to make a strong impression. Paul loved these people, and he deeply cares, but he is not going to look the other way and pretend that it's okay for them to go up to the temple for food. Paul spoke plainly. Flee from idolatry. Stay as far away from the temple of idols as you can. Christians do not hang out where there is a 4-in-1 restaurant, bar, brothel, temple in operation. You can't participate in any of that without being identified with all of it. I'm not a philosopher nor a psychologist, but it seems to me, from what little I know about the world, that human nature today is very much like it was back then. Christians go to movies to see vivid portrayals of sin and sinners. People killing each other. Adultery. Spouse abuse. And going for entertainment. Christians read books and magazines that describe sin and sinners. Why are we so curious about that stuff? Why are we interested in things that could alienate us from God forever? Oh, we're not going to do it. We have no intention of doing what's wrong, but it's fascinating. We don't want to sin. We just want to look. It seems we have a tendency to get as close as we can to the line between right and wrong. Why is that? What strange people we are. Don't know that any of us wants to be known in the community as religious. Oh, they're religious, you know. It's almost like saying they're naive, they're good, and said in a very negative way. So we don't want to appear too religious or too good because people will think we're weak. We don't want to break God's law, but sometimes we're drawn close enough to the line between right and wrong that we can look over the line and watch. Do you believe that being innocent, being naive, is a bad thing? What do you think? Jesus had no experiential knowledge of sin. He had no experience with doing anything that was wrong. Is that a flaw in his character? Is purity something that you wouldn't want to be accused of? Kids smoke cigarettes to prove something. They start out by trying to prove something. Nobody wants to look like he's afraid to do what the other kids do. And how immature and foolish to try to prove you're tough by giving in to their pressure. It makes no sense. Adults use foul language, and I'm convinced it's not because that terminology is a superior means of communication. Why would adults use such terminology? What's the point? Do we think we're going to impress people with filth and foul vocabulary? What are we doing? I am certainly not in favor of ebonics, but better ebonics than profanity. Every time a person gets out on the edge of God's will, it makes it easy for Satan to push him over the line. When a person wants to walk out on the edge, it's just a matter of time until they cross the line. They will cross the line. No human being is strong enough to walk there and not commit sin. So in verse 15, Paul said to them that they were smarter than that. Paul complimented them on being sensible, wise people. He said, you're intelligent. You know better than this. Going up to the temple. Paul said, flee from idolatry, which means run as far as you can get away from that which is the worst of sins, which strictly attacks God himself. Idolatry is not letting God be God. It's putting something in his place. What a sin it is. Now, of course, Americans don't worship idols. None of us worship idols. And generally speaking, even non-religious Americans don't worship idols. We're not that dumb. The only idols in America are in museums, in art galleries or somewhere. That's not true. An idol is anything that a man values more than the God who created him. Well, I don't know. You may have your own definition. You may have a different definition. Americans are too smart to worship idols. We're not really comfortable when somebody starts talking about the things we idolize. If a person idolizes something, if he has an extreme devotion to something, isn't that an idol? I mean, are we playing word games? For example, did you ever see a wall or a door that had been smashed through by an angry father because the Buffalo Bills lost a football game? Did you ever see that? Hole in the wall. I've seen that. That happened. Gary Vanderett, who lives on the West Coast, said that there was a time in his life when football and the Super Bowl gave him great satisfaction and enjoyment. He was a 49ers fan. When the 49ers lost a football game, he was devastated. It really affected him. He said it took him days to get over a loss by his team. Football dominated his life. It had a lot of influence on his schedule. When the 49ers won, it was ecstasy. He was on top of the world. When they lost, he was angry. It affected how he related to his family. It affected how he performed on the job. Nothing wrong with football. Nothing wrong with taking a stone and carving it to look like a person or a thing. Nothing wrong with whittling a piece of wood to look like a statue. Nothing wrong with that. But when things begin to control our emotions, dominate our minds, guide our minds, affect our relationships, isn't that idolatry? When things own us? When we become so attached that we can't be content without something, isn't that idolatry? Where is our faith in God if we need anything down here? Does the Prince of Peace live in you? Here's a test. I don't know if this will work for you. It's just a test. It's not profound. It's very simple. This is the test. In your own heart right now, today, is there anything that you would refuse to sell to help men and women believe in Jesus Christ? Is there something that you would refuse to give up for the Lord? Here's what King David said. As for me, I trust the Lord. Thou art my God. My soul thirsts for thee. Besides thee, I desire nothing on earth. Could you say that? The Corinthians had a problem. They just were attached to visiting the temple. They grew up on that. They became Christians. When they learned that an idol was nothing, going back up there to the temple was something they really wanted to do. They had this desire to go there. This desire was dominating them. To eat and drink the Lord's Supper is not just a symbolic meal. Right in the middle of dealing with their problem, the Apostle Paul brought up eating this meal. And Paul said to eat and drink the Lord's Supper is not just symbolic. To eat this, to partake of this, is to identify with the eternal Christ. To sit at this table means I am God's man. I am God's woman. That's who I am. I'm identifying myself. Everyone who partakes claims by his participation that he is one who worships Jesus as Lord. The communion table means that we are one body and all of us here are Christ's people. And when the Corinthians heard that, they said, okay, we understand that. No problem. Sure. Paul said eating the Lord's Supper means we are advocates of Christ and his teaching. We're united with him. We stand with him. Corinthians said, okay, sure, yeah, we understand that. Paul said, fine. Now, Paul said, look with me at one more meal back in the Old Testament. He said, let's watch Israel as they come together to worship. And they meet together at the altar, and the animal is killed. Part of it is burned. Part of it is eaten. Paul said the Israelites were identifying themselves with God and everything that that altar stands for. And the Corinthians said, okay, we understand that. No problem. And then in verse 21, Paul said, okay, no man can serve two masters. No one can serve two gods. There's no such thing as dual membership here, where we can participate in the Lord's table and go up there and participate in the table of demons. No dual membership. The Apostle Paul is saying, no more of this nice guy at church and then leave church and go out and swear and carouse with the best of them after hours. No more dual membership. No sitting at the Lord's table on Saturday, the Satan's table on Saturday, and the Lord's table on Sunday. In verse 22, Paul said point blank, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to make God jealous? Are you trying to make God angry? Do you want God mad at you? Are you so cocksure of yourself that you think you can handle him when he's upset with you and your behavior? Are you willing to take on the wrath of God? And then in verses 23 and following, Paul lists some principles. And Paul is saying, now, life is confusing and it's complicated. And I know you used to eat up there, and that was a part of life, and your friends still go there, and it's just food. I know that. But Paul said, here's some guidelines as to how you make the delicate decisions on what you're going to do in your daily conduct. We who sit at the Lord's table are to use our freedom in Christ to serve other people. Yes, we have a lot of freedom when it comes to managing our lives. I mean, aren't all of us here today free to choose what we're going to eat, where we're going to eat it, with whom we will eat? Aren't we free to do that? Why, sure, we're free. But our Lord did not live to please himself. He humbled himself to serve the needs of others. That's how Jesus lived, to serve the needs of others, not for himself. So Paul said in his letter to the Roman Christians, we who are strong ought to bear the weaknesses of those without strength and not just please ourselves. Paul said to the Romans, let each of us please our neighbor for his good, for even Christ himself did not please himself. The survey that I read about was, I think, about 2 years old. A survey of Americans across the country. They were asked, what is the goal of life? What is the goal of your life? What is the purpose of life? And most Americans said that the goal of life on earth is personal enjoyment and personal fulfillment. And that's pure paganism. Any Christian in Corinth who insisted that he could keep his mind pure while eating at the temple had already gone out of bounds because he was ignoring his Christian brother who was weak. Paul was saying, even if you could go up to that 4-in-1 hole in the wall and eat a meal and keep your mind clean, what about your weaker brother who can't? And what's your example doing to him? And Paul said, if you think you can do that, you're already out of bounds. Paul is trying to get us to think in terms of what is best for the kingdom and those around me, not me. Idols were nothing. The meat offered would not make them sick. But the temple of the idol was no place for a Christian to spend his free time. Those who sit at the Lord's table make their decisions based on what's best for the Lord's family and what's best for other people. And if that seems unfair to you, welcome to the world of being a Christian. Sure, it's unfair, but that's how Christians live. We're not looking for fair. We're looking to make our lives count for him. Dying on the cross for something he didn't do wasn't fair for Jesus. But we desperately needed him to do that, to free us from our guilt before God. So when I was 17 years old, I came to understand that in an immature, childlike way, I guess. But when I found out that Jesus had died because of the things I'd done wrong, from that time on, although I had a lot of growing to do and have struggled all through the years to do this, from the time I learned what he did for me, in my heart, what I wanted was whatever he said. That's okay with me. Whatever he asked, fine. Whatever he wants me to try to become, great. And I have stumbled and blundered big time in trying to do that. But that's what I wanted to do. Whatever Jesus says, that's okay. If giving up personal freedom can help others to know him, what have I got to lose? He's my Lord, and there's a future. Do any of us have an eating problem? We who sit at the Lord's table, we participate and identify ourselves here as being the people of God. We are Christians. Now, how do we conduct ourselves when we leave the table? And Paul says, there is one grand principle. This is in verse 31. I asked Keith to jump down from the paragraph he read to verse 31. Paul said, here's the principle that you take with you when you leave the table. Whether we eat or drink, or whatever we do all to the glory of God. Whether we're sitting at the table in the presence of the Lord with Him, eating and drinking, identifying with Him, or whatever, when we leave the table and go out there, we do everything to the glory of God. Now, that's not hard to understand. That's real hard to do. Christians decide everything they do based on whether or not it pleases God. So, somebody talks about an idea. Do you think Christian people ought to give up 2 weeks vacation time, leave their family, spend a lot of personal money, family money, and go to Nicaragua and work with a third world bunch of people for 2 weeks? Why, sure they ought to do that. Gladly do that. Because that honors Jesus Christ and it extends the kingdom. That's good. That's good stuff. That fits with the principle of verse 31. Do you think Christians ought to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth when it's income tax time? You think Christians ought to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth when you fill out a job application? You think Christians ought to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth when you sell a used car? Now, every once in a while, I just have this urge not to tell everything in situations. Would you allow me just for this moment a liberal paraphrase of something Jesus said? Insomuch as you have sold a used car unto one of the least of these my brethren, you've sold it unto me. I don't know. Can I say that? Should Christians eat meals with non-Christians? Absolutely. Our personal fellowship is with Christ, but our friendship is freely extended to non-Christians of every sort so that we can be light in their dark world. When we eat with someone, we are acknowledging that they have worth as a person. Do you understand? That's what it means when somebody invites you out to dinner. When somebody says, hey, can we get together for lunch? Do you understand that the very fact that they would share in a meal time with you was saying to the Hebrews, you're worth something to me. I'd like to have a relationship with you. When Jesus said about this, take, eat, this is my body, Jesus was saying, I want to be your friend. I'd like to have a relationship with you. When Mike Bowers gets on another airplane, goes to another continent, no, when Mike goes to visit those other peoples of the world, they give him whatever they're eating, you know, and Mike eats it, and I've talked with him about some of it, and that's hard, but Mike always eats it because sharing their food says, you're worth something to me. I would enjoy having a relationship with you. I want to have a relationship with you. When Jesus ate with sinners of all kinds, he was saying, I want to help you. I want to be your friend. So would you make it a point to watch for opportunities in your life to eat with people who need the light that is in you because you're a Christian? Would you follow in Jesus' steps? Christian freedom is not free to do everything I can for my own benefit. That's not what Christian freedom is all about. In verse 33, freedom is doing what I can do to benefit other people and for the salvation of others. Christian freedom is freedom from myself and freedom from my desires which tend to control me so that I can serve the God who created me. There's a slang saying, it's a byline, I don't know what to call it. I'm sure you've heard this expression in the last couple of years. Somebody says to somebody else, get a life. Have you heard that? Yeah, why don't you get a life? And what a negative, bitter, critical statement that is. Get a life. And the Apostle Paul said, I don't have a life except to live for Jesus Christ. I get the impression that the Apostle Paul was ready to go the second mile and the third mile and the fourth mile and how many ever miles he needed to if he could show people that he loved them and that Jesus Christ was the one thing he lived for. We sang minutes ago, there is a name I love to hear. I love to sing its worth. That's Paul. That's how he lived. The Apostle Paul gave up all of his personal rights when he surrendered his life to Jesus. I'm saying that the Apostle Paul's baptism was valid. An old sinful life was buried in a grave of water. A new man was raised up from the water to live every minute from there on for his Lord. Paul had died. A new man was raised up. And the new man was Christ's man. Conversion is the most significant experience that a man or woman could ever have. Conversion. To identify with him. To accept his offer of forgiveness of sin. To eat at his table. To be his friend. To be on good terms with God. Jesus wants to forgive every one of us. He wants to make us clean. He wants to make us new. That's true for people who are not Christians yet. And that's true for all of us who are, who've messed up. He wants us to be clean and new, so that we can actually serve a righteous, holy God in a way that counts and makes a difference. Why? Why, Lord? Why? Because we have worth to him, and he wants to spend eternity with us. And you learn all of that at the cross. That's where we first saw the light. 279. Will you turn to that? Stand with me as we sing the first verse together. 279.